Greetings, one and all. My name is Dan Poneman, and I am the co-chair, along with Admiral Rich Meese, of the Nuclear Energy and National Security Coalition. We bring people together to discuss the pressing issues of the day with respect to these compelling issues and get the best experts available to help enlighten our listeners. And we are extremely fortunate today to have two of the grandmasters of nuclear nonproliferation strategy joining us to discuss the very important issue of U.S.-Saudi nuclear cooperation and its imperatives for national security. And I'm referring to two esteemed colleagues and good friends. And I'll start with the one I met first, Bob Einhorn. Even before we get Pranay into the business, Bob and I have between us over a century of work on nonproliferation. Bob, one day we'll get it right. I first met Bob when he was at an organization once known as the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency. He rose through the ranks, ultimately becoming Assistant Secretary of State for Nonproliferation, and now is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. A more recent but also valued colleague, Pranay Vaddi, who encumbers a job which the title has changed, but basically was the chair I sat in at the National Security Council, where he was Senior Director for Arms Control, Disarmament, and Nonproliferation. He is now a Senior Fellow at the MIT Center for Nuclear Security Policy. In full disclosure, I am on the advisory board of that esteemed group. And both of these gentlemen have extensive experience with Saudi Arabia and with nonproliferation. So let's get started. I'll set it up just to say that the question of nuclear cooperation in the Middle East in general and Saudi Arabia in particular has been one that has been quite active for many, many years. When I was Deputy Secretary of Energy, there was a lot of discussion with the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia in light of their growing interest. They started, of course, very focused on their petroleum sector, which is legendary, but they have been very interested in diversifying their oil wealth to enable them to conserve that wealth for use in subsequent years and also to provide themselves with sufficient clean energy for their growing energy needs. They have been, as you would expect, avidly courted by any number of nuclear vendors. And the question has been for many years, what sort of nonproliferation conditions would attach to that cooperation and who ultimately would gain the opportunity to work with the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia in developing its nuclear energy program. So let's dive right in with these experts. And Bob, let's start with you. You have written, you've published on this, and you have emphasized that the foremost U.S. interest is nuclear security and nonproliferation. And given your background and thinking in that area, how should Washington think about engaging with Saudi Arabia?
Well, first of all, thank you, Dan. It's a pleasure to be with you and with Pranay on this podcast. Let me add a bit of context here. The Biden administration saw a civil nuclear deal as part of a package that together with a new U.S.-Saudi defense agreement could gain the kingdom's support for normalizing its relations with Israel. But the Gaza war took normalization off the table, at least for the time being. And the Trump administration is pursuing a civil nuclear deal as a standalone measure, delinked from normalization. I think, and Pranay could add to this, but I think that's where the Biden administration may have headed at the end, but kind of ran out of time on a bilateral civil nuclear deal. Now, in my view, a standalone agreement is warranted. A U.S.-Saudi civil nuclear deal could serve several important U.S. interests. A civil nuclear deal could help revitalize the U.S. Nuclear industry, both by providing a market for U.S. nuclear exports and a potential source of investment in American nuclear energy infrastructure, especially in a U.S.-based enrichment operation. It could also reinforce a long-term strategic relationship with the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. And it would provide a window into Saudi nuclear thinking and an opportunity to influence Saudi nuclear choices on a range of matters. But in the absence of effective controls, it could also lead to a Saudi nuclear weapons program and create a precedent for damaging the global non-proliferation regime. And we don't have to speculate about Saudi nuclear intentions. Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman declared that if Iran acquires nuclear weapons, the KSA will do the same. And so a challenge for the Trump administration is to negotiate a deal that achieves strategic and civil nuclear energy benefits, which are substantial, without increasing the risks of proliferation. The key, in my view, will be how the deal handles fuel cycle capabilities, that is, enrichment and reprocessing. And I assume, Dan, you're going to want to come back to that.
We will indeed, and you framed the issue very well. I mean, this is always the dilemma that we face in nuclear, going back to the origins of atomic fission and the Einstein letter, and first, I think perhaps in a meaningful way, put into a policy context that had legs by President Eisenhower in his December 8th, 1953, Atoms for Peace vision, where he talked about constraining the risk of nuclear weapons at the same time as making the benefits to humanity in terms of not just energy, but also medicine and agriculture available through peaceful nuclear cooperation. So that tees it up well, I think, for Pranay, because you were actually at the table negotiating with the Saudis in the last administration. And informed by what we just heard from Bob and your own knowledge, why does U.S. participation matter from a national security standpoint? How can we use our participation to protect those nonproliferation interests that Bob has articulated? For example, through transparency measures, consent authority, our overall engagement and influence with the program, etc.
Thanks, Dan. That's a great question. Let me just offer my compliments to the coalition. I think it's really important work. You've pulled together a great group of experts and senior officials to make sure that we connect this hopeful nuclear energy renaissance to U.S. national security interests. And I think that the three of us have all had experience in the U.S. government, really leading with non-proliferation when we try to engage in these nuclear cooperation conversations with other countries, and Saudi Arabia is no different. As you mentioned, Bob framed this issue up really well, including what U.S. interests are here and Saudi interests. But I'll dive into the U.S. national security interests in response to your question. Some of this comes from something that's always been the case for U.S. government non-proliferation policy and its intersection with nuclear energy cooperation, which is we feel that the United States is the best possible exporter of nuclear technology when it comes to securing non-proliferation obligations and transparency by our partners, the importer or the customer. And that's really been at the heart of U.S. non-proliferation strategy for the past few decades. Now, what has been difficult, of course, is the U.S. nuclear industry has eroded over time. Our ability to enrich has eroded over time. The amount of nuclear power plants under construction in the U.S. is much lower than that of a country like China. But we've maintained a pretty high standard for what we expect in terms of non-proliferation cooperation as a part of these nuclear trade agreements. So where the U.S. interest is here on the non-proliferation side of things is making sure that we're the partners at the table with the Saudis who are helping building their civil nuclear industry, whether that starts with mining and ends with spent fuel disposition and everything in between, or is just focused on power plants, because the United States will make it a critical piece of the negotiations to ensure that Saudi Arabia follows through on its non-proliferation commitments. I think we've seen some good progress. There's evidence that this type of collaboration has borne fruit. We saw Saudi Arabia announce late last year it was planning to rescind its small quantities protocol. And what that means in IAEA parlance is they are preparing to actually bring their comprehensive safeguards agreement with the IAEA into force. And what that should mean for the general audience here is that Saudi Arabia was willing to accept these intrusive inspections as part of its agreement with the IAEA, which is a good first step to building a civil nuclear program. One of the things that the United States needs to do in its a cooperation with Saudi Arabia and why it should cooperate with Saudi Arabia in this space is to ensure that other countries that might be able to export nuclear technology but don't have high standards of non-proliferation, like China and Russia, don't get in the door. So that's why it's important for the US to get in there first.
Yeah, this is a tough one, and I think we're vectoring right in on the hardest part of this. Again, when Bob Einhorn and I were first working on this, we were just implementing the Non-Proliferation Act of 1978. The Congress added a whole bunch of non-proliferation conditions that had not been standard globally, such as requiring full-scope safeguards, such as prior consent on a lot of activities, such as plutonium reprocessing, omnibus export controls, etc. And we spent, including the three of us, about 15, 20 years getting most of those implemented. And then we couldn't leave well enough alone, and we went still further with something that has become known as the gold standard and so forth. The problem has been that while that first set of ramp-ups in the Non-Proliferation Act of 1978 through the Nuclear Suppliers Group and a lot of just shoe leather diplomacy that, again, all of us have been engaged in, we got most of the countries to live pretty much up to those standards, right? But then in going further in trying to curtail people's access to fuel cycle activities like uranium enrichment and plutonium reprocessing, we went further than other countries did. And since other countries have been very aggressive commercially, that does put us into a tight spot of how to, exactly as the three of us agreed, keep the highest non-proliferation standards applying to these countries who do have other choices beyond the United States. So, Bob, given this complex, almost Hobson's choice, how should we think about navigating that to the point that Pranay made, that we want it to be us and not the Chinese and the Russians who actually are not cooperating with us in the way they used to on nonproliferation? If they end up in the driver's seat in this program, you can be sure that our nonproliferation standards will not be upheld. But we do want these standards upheld. How do we navigate this very narrow passage between this Scylla and Charybdis of China and Russia?
Well, before I get into Russia and China, I need to kind of go back to where the Saudis are in the negotiations with us. As part of a civil nuclear deal with the Biden administration, the Saudis wanted the United States to construct a uranium enrichment facility in the kingdom. And I'm sure, as your listeners know, enrichment is a kind of facility that can produce low-enriched uranium to fuel nuclear reactors, but is inherently capable of being modified to produce highly enriched uranium for nuclear weapons. This was the policy, this was the proposal of the Saudis with the Biden administration, as Pranay knows very well. I assume it remains the proposal with the Trump administration for the US to construct an enrichment facility in the kingdom. And as you mentioned, Dan, for a half a century now, the United States has opposed the transfer of fuel cycle capabilities to non-nuclear weapon states, and it has been a remarkably successful policy. Since the demise of the AQCON black market network, no state or non-state actor has transferred fuel cycle technologies to non-nuclear weapon states. Now, U.S. construction of an enrichment plant in Saudi Arabia would be a major reversal of that long-standing U.S. non-proliferation policy. In my view, I don't know if you share this view, but I don't believe the United States should build an enrichment facility in the kingdom, at least not at the present time. Currently, there is no programmatic or commercial justification for a Saudi domestic enrichment program. But I do think it would be possible to keep the door open to a future Saudi enrichment program while avoiding near-term proliferation risks. The United States and Saudi Arabia could agree to a moratorium on the fuel cycle capability, a moratorium on any fuel cycle activities in the kingdom, perhaps for 10 years. During that period, the two sides would jointly study the economic, programmatic, and non-proliferation implications of pursuing such capabilities. At the end of the period, they could make a decision on whether to proceed, and if so, on the constraints needed to prevent the fuel cycle program from leading to a nuclear weapons capability. Deferring a fuel cycle decision in this manner would allow the two sides to engage in a wide range of mutually advantageous civil nuclear activities in the near term, and to do so without raising non-proliferation concerns. In any event, that's my way of trying to square the circle.
All right, well, I'd like to dig into that one, Bob, and I'm going to flip it to Pranay, but maybe just as they say in law school, complicate the hypo a little bit. So another way to say what you just said, one might not to modify your proposal, but you could sort of flip it because if, for example, you go back to the proposal that Ernie Moniz and John Deutsch and Arne Kanter and I made back in 2004, we said we're going to promise anybody who signs up to the NPT and safeguards guaranteed fuel supply for X number of years. And sort of implicitly, the first part of your proposal becomes the second part of that one. After that, you could do these things, but it framed it in, if you will, commercial non-compete terms instead of testosterone testing, Article 4 sovereignty defense things, not to get into the jargon. So I guess let me just complicate this a little bit and flip it back to Pranay on this question of timing. And first of all, I would like you to comment on your thoughts around building a plant, a black box plant in Saudi Arabia. But I just saw, and I've only had a chance to skim it, Ernie Moniz recently published an article in Foreign Policy about an idea that's been kicking around since I've been working on this 50 years ago, was a regional fuel center. Is that a way to perhaps finesse or address this issue in the meantime? And also, please do comment on another proposal that's been kicking around and that I've had something to do with from time to time, which is allowing foreign entities, not confined to, but certainly including Saudi Arabia, to invest in U.S. enrichment capacity in the United States of America. So, Pranay, with that congeries of issues, take it away.
Yeah, let me say at the outset, I think where you ended is kind of where I'm at. I think finding ways to bring foreign investment into U.S. enrichment capability in the United States should be the starting point here. We all know that the United States wants to get back into the enrichment game. We also know the United States is the only country with the wealth and the industrial capability. If we really do want to put a dent in Russia's stranglehold over the uranium market, it's probably going to happen here. And of course, it solves a lot of non-proliferation and nuclear security problems that are in the ether if we're building a plant in the United States, where we've already demonstrated there are examples of multilateral run enrichment capabilities in the US through Urenco. And so sort of a quasi black box format. Now, to your former question, look, I think we have to go back to the political reality here. The United States is always going to have heightened concerns about building an enrichment plant anywhere else other than the United States. It's tough enough to build one here in the US. And so we have to establish some practical reality here. What is the increase in price going to be if the United States tries to do this in Saudi Arabia, knowing that the Saudi interest in this is not necessarily just commercial. It is a strategic capability as well. The Crown Prince's comments regarding wanting a nuclear weapon if Iran is able to get one are something that looms large over this entire question. The United States also has to think about what the safety of that facility would be in a region that's been beset by conflict now for the past few years, active conflict, and what other allies might think of having a facility like this in the Middle East. And finally, diving into the commerciality of such a facility. As you both know, enrichment's not really a profitable business per se. It's going to take, and things may be different. I mean, in this new nuclear renaissance age, maybe fuel demand is so high that this becomes a profitable enterprise for the Saudis. But the reality is, I think that the commoditization of enrichment of uranium is not going to be the same as the production of heavy fuel oil, diesel, or other petroleum products that provide a lot of the sovereign wealth for Middle Eastern countries. This is just a different game entirely. So I agree with what Bob stated, which is we really do need to take the time to study the commercial viability of running a plant like this in Saudi Arabia. To me, the best way to do that is try to build that multinational pilot facility through foreign investment in the United States, have it run by a US contracted company, and then use that facility to be your source of study for not just commercial viability, but what do we need to do in the non-proliferation safeguard space? How do all countries develop familiarity with nuclear security who are participating? That's an opportunity for investors to not necessarily get access to sensitive centrifuge technology that you get in running the plant, but it does give you ex expertise in sort of balance of plant operations, and then, of course, all of the obligations that come with hosting nuclear material in your country to the IAEA.
That's really interesting, Pranay, and not to put words in either of your mouth, but I can sort of bringing yours and Bob's last intervention together. What I might call a friendly amendment to Bob, you could say not, and he didn't really say never, but he said not now. So to take off from that, to say, hey, look, let's be smart about this. Let's, walk before we run. And the way to be smart about this and get you all in Saudi Arabia familiar with safeguards, familiar with the investment, familiar with the business case, not familiar with technology, which even under the most aggressive scenario, I think would be black boxed, would be, as you suggest, Pranay, like trying it on for size in the United States. By the way, there's precedent for multilateral finance of enrichment facility. Eurodif in France was had investments, including from Iran, for many, many years. So that's kind of an interesting way to sort of sequence it. For our viewers, I meant to mention before, Bob mentioned AQ Khan, and it's worth, just in case anybody doesn't know, this is a case of a Pakistani engineer who was employed by the multinational company known as Urenco, which is a tripart company owned by the British, the Germans, and the Dutch. And he basically stole the blueprints and basically spread them out to Pakistan, to Iran, to North Korea. And it was the most egregious non-proliferation breach that we've ever experienced. U.S. diplomacy back in the 70s had been successful at persuading Germany not to sell that kind of technology to Brazil, France not to sell that kind of technology to Pakistan, but AQ Khan blew a huge hole in the boat. But anyway, you both have now lit upon the sort of geostrategic aspects of this. Obviously, Saudi Arabia sits at the crossroads of energy, finance, leadership in the region. As Bob mentioned initially, during the Biden administration, the whole nuclear deal was part of a much wider strategic deal that was in the offing prior to the October 7th heinous attacks that have changed the face of the region so dramatically. But in any way you look at it, civil nuclear cooperation has become a central instrument of statecraft in the region. Russia and China have quite clearly been using it in a bunch of countries and a bunch of continents, including Africa, to forge long-term dependencies and to project their own influence. And sometimes there are people who have said that the U.S. has been so punctilious about its non-proliferation standards that we have given short shrift to the broader geostrategic aspects at a time in which, because of our commercial weakness that has developed over time in the nuclear sector, we don't have the leverage that we used to have. And as Ernie Moniz has said in other settings, no exports, no influence. So how do we think about the role of civil nuclear in the region in our negotiations with Saudi Arabia, and how should we play this now with the impending visit of the Crown Prince? So this time, Pranay, let's start with you this time.
Yeah, great questions, Dan. And of course, we're all non-proliferation nerds, but you know that that requires us to have a sense of what's going on in the world as well. Look, I think that much like this administration's thinking about it, the last administration thought about it, and the first Trump term thought about this, this potential civil nuclear partnership is one of many aspects of the major power competition that's taking place in the world. And so, particularly for the United States, in thinking about China's influence in the Middle East, we're going to continue to have worries about the China-Emirati relationship. in high-end technologies, including chips. We're going to continue to have concerns about China's investment in the region, both to get military bases, investment in energy markets in Arab countries to get a fair deal on fuel purchase, and then, of course, being willing to exchange Chinese technology for those things. There's also legacy interest by Russia, as they have been nuclear exporters. They've built reactors in the region, or trying to build some in Turkey as well. And so I think it's in U.S. interest, as we're thinking about these major power relations, to try its best to box those other major powers that are adversaries out of the region, particularly as it relates to strategic technology cooperation, of which I think nuclear cooperation is one segment. I mean, let's keep in mind that we're really not just in a nuclear renaissance as it relates to legacy nuclear technology. We have all sorts of new technologies that are coming to the fore as well, all of which may have different fuel types, all of which may have different requirements for disposing of spent fuel, and all of which may offer different proliferation risks when you think about fourth generation small modular reactors. All of these risks are manageable. We've spent our careers trying to manage those risks, including through international cooperation. So for the United States, if you don't have your foot in the door, and I liked your quote from former Secretary of Energy Moniz, if you're not the exporter, you're not providing these technologies, which is something that our country is capable of, then you're going to cede this ground to others. And so I think you'll see nuclear cooperation lashed up with cooperation in AI, in chips and data centers. You're going to see this sort of total package of strategic technology cooperation come together. And unfortunately, it's really hard on the US government, given the different stovepipes that exist, to marry those things up. We tried to do that in the Biden administration at the White House. I'm sure that the Trump administration is trying to do the same things, but you really need to see progress on all of these fronts if one of the key goals that I've articulated, and I think the administration would agree with, is making sure the US is there and our adversaries are not.
Well put. Well, let's take it right from there. And Bob, since you've had to deal with these kinds of issues at the front lines in government, just to worst case analysis this, which we have to do, if it would turn out that China and or Russia became the nuclear partner to Saudi Arabia and not the United States, what would that mean, A, for U.S. nonproliferation interests, and B, for U.S. wider strategic interests in the Middle East?
Yeah, I'm glad you raised that question, Dan. Look, I agree that civil nuclear cooperation can help reinforce a bilateral relationship with another country. But nuclear cooperation is only one element of a relationship that also includes security, economic, political, and historical ties. And these other elements are often more important sources of leverage and influence with a cooperating partner than civil nuclear cooperation. For example, Russia is building a reactor in Egypt largely because of the generous financial terms that the Russian government is prepared to offer. But the United States remains Egypt's most important strategic partner, as evidenced by the close U.S.-Egyptian cooperation recently on Gaza. So, sure, there are strategic benefits for the United States in reaching a civil nuclear deal with Saudi Arabia, and the Trump administration should make every effort to achieve an effective agreement and, as much as possible, keep Russia and China out. If an effective agreement can't be reached with Saudi Arabia, it doesn't mean that the KSA will automatically become a dependency of Russia or China. The most likely alternative to the United States is probably South Korea, which has successfully built four nuclear reactors in the UAE and is already working with Saudi Arabia on a small modular reactor. Yes. Much preferred for us to engage in cooperation with Saudi Arabia than Russia and China. As Pranay has pointed out, their insistence on tough nonproliferation restrictions is much less than ours. But we shouldn't exaggerate the risks of failing to conclude a U.S.-Saudi civil nuclear deal. The risks of negotiating an inadequate deal that facilitates proliferation in Saudi Arabia or elsewhere may be an even greater risk.
No easy choices here. And since we're now in the area and we're coming toward the end of our time of the broader strategic economic dimensions, let me just flip that straight to Pranay. I mean, you have the Moniz maxim, no exports, no influence. You hear Bob saying, you know, maybe not so much. Given where we are, given where the Saudis are, given, and I think here I'd like to bring in just referentially the broader US industry, which is struggling, right? And the Russian order book globally for nuclear power is $200 billion. And the US order book, although I think we're all hoping for the best in Poland and Bulgaria, I think it's still zero in terms of, you know, signed deals with cash flow, right? So, I guess the question to you is thinking practically and tactically, given all of these cross currents, what should the United States do at the current moment on this potential US-Saudi nuclear deal?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great point, Dan. And I think even just beyond the US-Saudi deal, we need to find the right balance in the United States to help a struggling industry grow into what I think is too often considered a secondary market, nuclear exports. I think right now a lot of the nuclear energy industry is probably focused on satisfying the need by tech companies to the growing electricity demands of data centers to power AI advancement in the United States. It's very much a domestic focus, and there's a lot of reason why that should be the case. But as you point out, there's worldwide demand for nuclear power right now, and US companies need to be ready to seize that. I do think it's very difficult for the US industry and the state it's in to do that on its own. And so finding partnerships with like-minded allies and partners who also have nuclear industries and can help with that export process is going to be really important. So, for example, we have a natural partner in South Korea who has proven their ability to build things in the Middle East. The Barak reactors at UAE loom large. I wouldn't say that they came in under time and under cost, but they're a lot closer than the last time the United States company tried to build reactors. The United Kingdom is trying to rebuild its own nuclear industry and it's putting its federal money into that process as well. And we also could have natural partners in Japan, in Canada as well. So I do think that much like with our revitalization of our defense industrial base in the United States, our nuclear industrial base needs to be not just a US problem to solve, but something that we solve with our allies. Hopefully that leads to both investments here at home for the US nuclear industry, but also easier pairings if the US is able to share its technology and collaborate with close allies and partners that it trusts to build abroad, including in places like Saudi Arabia. So I think mission number one for me, and my recommendation for this administration would be go find those partners that help make a Saudi project a reality and get the Saudis on board with that. The other point I'll make, I think Bob made a really good point earlier, which is this doesn't all need to happen at once. We oftentimes focus on getting the best and most comprehensive deal nailed down. I think staging this is really important. In the initial phases of 1-2-3 cooperation, for example, I think the United States and Saudi Arabia should focus on building two nuclear power plants. This has been the request of the Saudi Arabia. They've put out an open bid for two plants. It's been out there for a long time. Focus on accomplishing that first. You can kind of fill in the blanks as it relates to spent fuel management, fuel production, mining, et cetera, as that demand grows for the Saudi nuclear industry if it does expand. But for right now, I think they need to take one chunk of this, perhaps the least controversial chunk, and just try to nail that down.
Interesting idea. All right, we really have just a few minutes. So this has been a very rich discussion crossing a lot of different issues. Let me just try to bring this back, a final comment from each of you. Given what Pranay just suggested, and Bob, given the challenges you've described in terms of optimizing U.S. interests, given our high nonproliferation standards, but also strong competition, and taking into account what you said about it may not be Russia and China, it may be Korea, and maybe Korea, as Pranay suggests, in partnership with the US. But we don't get to choose alternatives that we don't control, right? So just to, you know, put you a little bit on the spot, if you had one piece of advice to give to the current negotiating team, on how to optimize U.S. interests, including nonproliferation, against the risk of it going to China or Russia, which are both very aggressive. What would your advice be? I mean, obviously, Pranay has suggested a potential partnering with the Koreans, which could make up some of our deficits. I don't want to put words in your mouth at all, but how do you think facing some of these really tough issues, if it came down to, and by the way, the Lee Jae-myung administration has not got the same views on nuclear that his predecessor did. So I don't think we can assume that's the outcome, right? But if you had one piece of advice to give how to maximize U.S. national security and nonproliferation and overall interests, what would that be?
You say, what should the U.S. do next?
Yeah.
MBS is coming to Washington November 18th. The U.S. and Saudi teams are working hard to try to complete the 1-2-3 agreement, and I'm encouraged that that the U.S. team involves real technical experts. It's very good, but it's going to be impossible to complete a 1-2-3 agreement in that time. My advice to them would be to seek some kind of a framework agreement containing the basic elements of a deal that could be fleshed out in further negotiation. And I think that framework agreement should cover three basic questions. One, fuel cycle capabilities. And there, I repeat my idea of a time-limited moratorium on fuel cycle activities to be reconsidered later. Second would be strong verification. I think both you and Pranay have referred to it. I think the critical would be for the Saudis to adhere to the IAEA additional protocol. And third, I think it's important that a framework agreement to be issued in November should talk about areas of nuclear cooperation under an eventual 1-2-3 agreement. Pranay had mentioned, purchasing two nuclear reactors from the U.S. or a U.S.-South Korean cooperative arrangement, and others as well. A plan for helping the Saudis on safety, security, on developing a regulatory framework, and so forth. But in looking at U.S.-Saudi cooperation, I think it would be desirable for that agreement to provide for what's called U.S. exclusivity, which is as long as the U.S. is engaged in nuclear cooperation with Saudi Arabia, Saudi Arabia will not engage in cooperation with a third party unless there's agreement between the United States and Saudi Arabia. Now, I understand that exclusivity was an element in the Biden administration's negotiations. I think it also has come up in the Trump administration negotiations. But if there can be some arrangement involving exclusivity, I think this could give a huge boost to the US nuclear industry.
Interesting. Of course, in business, you never get something for nothing. So presumably there is some price, I don't know what, for that exclusivity, but an interesting idea. Pranay, I'll give you the last word. Same basic question. What would you do now given the whole set of circumstances we've been describing and informed by what you just heard from Bob in terms of what he would recommend in terms of how to address these issues in the coming months?
Yeah, thanks, Dan. And I'm very honored to have the last word here, given that you two have lived and known more about this subject matter than I have. Look, I think if you mentioned at the outset, first of all, I agree with everything that Bob said. I think that's a smart approach to get through the Crown Prince's visit to Washington. As far as the 1-2-3 agreement goes, as you mentioned at the outset, there are these nine conditions in Section 123 that the U.S. has to keep in mind. So if you want the agreement to be considered conforming and speed through the Congress under expedited consideration under the Atomic Energy Act, it needs to meet these really high nonproliferation standards. My advice to the new team is make sure you have a conforming agreement. You should have an agreement that satisfies all of these strict non-proliferation considerations, no retransfer of material, technology, or data without US consent. Comprehensive safeguards have to be in place. Those safeguards have to exist in perpetuity, et cetera, et cetera. Foregoing enrichment reprocessing is not technically one of the nine conditions. However, for the purposes of getting this agreement off the ground and taking into account congressional politics, my advice would be you need to include some type of advanced consent requirement, if not the gold standard that you referenced, just to get this 1-2-3 over. It's important to keep in mind that in a complex relationship, we might have this sort of staging take place where the Saudis may want to come back to the table 10 years or 10 years or 20 years from now and renegotiate provisions to allow for enrichment, as Bob outlined. But if you're the United States, you shouldn't focus on that in the beginning. Focus on where you agree, which I think is building a couple of reactors, getting cooperation with the IAEA underway, hopefully with the additional protocol in place, and then seeing what the commercial viability is of a Saudi nuclear industry. So keep it simple, stupid, is my basic advice. Focus on what everyone agrees on and what you can get through the hill.
Excellent advice. As Bob Einhorn referenced, I think a lot of this is particularly relevant with the upcoming visit of the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman, otherwise known as MBS. I want to thank both of my esteemed colleagues for a really insightful conversation. I learned a lot. I hope our listeners, I'm sure our listeners did too. So I want to thank Bob Einhorn, Senior Fellow at the Brookings Institution, Pranay Vaddi, Senior Fellow at the MIT Center for Nuclear Security Policy, both with their distinguished record of public service. I want to close by thanking the Nuclear Energy and National Security Coalition, which I have the honor to co-lead with Admiral Rich Meese, former STRATCOM commander, and we are very interested in hearing from you, our listeners. So if you go to nensc.org, you'll find anything and everything you want to know. Please reach out, contact us. We will be back to you soon with another podcast in our series. So, gentlemen, thank you very much and have a great day.